The report lists 11 instances in which the president attempted or attempted to have others attempt to interfere with the investigation of his own campaign. Depending on how you look at them, it might be enough to prosecute. But it did show a venal, amoral, deceptive Donald Trump instructing his aides to lie and willing to help them do so. That's not good in the president of the United States.
That was the great Judge Andrew Napolitano last week reacting to the long-awaited release of special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into what Mueller concluded was candidate Donald Trump's unprosecutable dealings with Russia during the 2016 campaign and President Trump's more legally problematic moves to thwart the investigation thereof. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Editor's Roundtable edition of the Reason podcast. I'm Matt Welch, joined per usual by Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Morning, folks.
Good morning.
Hi, Matt.
Happy Mueller Monday.
Just a plug up top here, if you are listening to this correctly, on the Monday that it was released, I will be on the boob tube with the aforementioned Judge Napolitano tonight. What part of the Constitution does it say? As he subs for our pal Kennedy on the Fox Business Network.
You know who else is going to be on?
And Matt, if we're...
Peter Suderman. It's going to be a Matt Welch, Peter Suderman. I have no idea what I'm going to be talking about tonight, but whatever the judge asks me
about. What a vile person Matt Welch is. A venal,
they're going to have to turn off his earpiece during that segment.
I'm going to be on...
I'm going to say great things about Matt Welch.
I'm going to be on with the judge tomorrow.
Moderation
tomorrow night.
Of the Reason podcast.
What I'm going to say is about the way that Peter Suderman talks when other people talk, and also how he posts really awesome photos of himself in the 90s wearing Christian metal shirts that we were talking about before we hit the record button, sadly, because I think that should be immortalized forever. So the Mueller investigation has obviously dominated American politics for the past 2 years. It has not dominated this particular podcast over that time, in part because there's only so many different ways you could say, we'll have to wait and see. So now that I think Seth Abramson's tweet storm has finally ended here, it's fine. It's time and fine to kind of bring our own conclusory thoughts here to bring this particular episode of South Park to a close. And explain what we've all learned, particularly in terms of libertarian lessons from the past 2 years of American life. Catherine, since you're the Sansa of Reason, is that the am I pronouncing that
Thank
right?
Thank you.
Sansa. I don't know what this means, but I think that you're excited about it on the Twitter machine. What is a big takeaway from the delivery of this report from your admittedly weird libertarian point of view?
Thank you for that introduction to my view as admittedly weird. I feel like I should do that admitting if we're going to admit it. No, I mean, my takeaway, which I attempted to share with the viewers of MSNBC yesterday to mixed results, what is basically that everybody should be impeached more often. This is my baseline view before the report came out. And like literally everyone in America, nothing about my baseline view was changed by the report. So everyone who thought he should be impeached now thinks he should be impeached. Everyone who thought he was not guilty now thinks he's not guilty. Repeat ad infinitum for every other category of political views in the country. But I am with Gene Healy, who wrote a great piece for us a little while back, saying essentially the impeachment power should be used more often by Congress, that if you think about the rogues gallery of absolute bastards who have run this country, more of them should have been called up and called to account. Trump is probably one of those who should be called to account. But there's nothing in this report that particularly strengthens that view, contra the more legalistic thinkers like the judge. I don't think that there is a threshold that the report could have crossed because, as many people have said, impeachment is political. And the founders knew it was political and partisan. And so whether or not the president is impeached will be entirely down to political and partisan dynamics, not to the specific legalisms of what was in those 448 pages.
Peter, you live in D.C. What's your big takeaway from this?
In some ways, you know, I'm a little bit with Catherine in that I don't think it changed my mind radically. It did solidify some things for me. In particular, I think it makes a very clear case that Trump is simply unfit to be president. And I don't know any way to sort of beat around the bush, sort of to sugarcoat that or to kind of not reach
to sugarcoat that bush.
Right. Yeah. To beat around that bush or sugarcoat that conclusion. So, or like I just like Trump. Trump is unable to perform the duties that that the president is supposed to be performing. And so you see repeatedly that he has asked his aides to do things that are illegal, unlawful, unconstitutional, and that the only reason they don't get done is because his aides, sometimes including folks who we really don't like, but sometimes including folks who have done other quite good things, like Don McGahn, who has run Trump's judges program and helped sort of push conservative and libertarian-ish judges onto the bench, they have refused to do that, and that is a bad situation. That is a really bad situation to be in, where the president's judgment, the person who has the most political power in the country, arguably the most political power of any individual in the world, has incredibly bad judgment, doesn't know what's legal and what's not, is instructing his people to lie, is lying himself, and is instructing his people to do things that go beyond what the law and the Constitution allows. And so, you know, I know that, you know, Nick has written, I think, and I get this perspective, but like I know that there's sort of a line of libertarian thinking that says, well, you know, we should not be invested in the personality of the president because what we should care about are the policies. But in this case, Trump's personality is what is driving a lot of his policies. And Trump, because Trump runs the executive branch, we see a focus on trade and immigration. Because Trump is the president, we have Stephen Miller running immigration policies, where he is out on vacation in France on a presidential trip to France, yelling at people over the phone, trying to get individual people deported. That was reported in Politico this morning. And so I think that what this report really drives home is that you can't ignore the personality and the capability, the kind of low-lying fundamental competence of the president, and that Donald Trump simply isn't up to it.
Nick, your name was taken in vain. Where is Suderman wrong? What's a big takeaway from the Gillespie School?
Matt, but can you introduce me with some kind of disparaging?
It's all just implied by now, isn't it? Nick, you're from New Jersey. Right. This behavior seems normal to you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no. If anything, it's aspirational. He's really getting closer to heaven. What the Mueller report, as Catherine's pointing out, and a bunch of people have commented that it's kind of a Rorschach test where whatever you came in with, you leave with, in terms of views and opinions about Trump. I disagree that Trump is not up to the office of presidency or more fully that the office of the presidency is holding up pretty well, because Trump did ask a bunch of people who are idiots for working for him to do a bunch of stuff. In virtually all the cases, they chose not to. We know what Trump is about, and we know what his policies are, and we know what his personal dealings are, and we can factor that in as we move forward, and certainly in 2020. But it's, I just don't think that the Mueller report obviously satisfies anybody's need for anything. But it is really important to point out that in the major finding, there was no collusion with Russia, an active collusion between Trump and Russian agents trying to influence the election. That's really good to know, and that's kind of comforting to know. And the other thing then is that we're sliding from, without even talking about it, it was all about collusion. Now it's all about obstruction. Now it's about this. And it's like, I think it's time to really start talking about policy again. And again, to this question of like, Trump may be incompetent. I think everything that Judge Napolitano said in the clip is absolutely right. He's venal. He's arrogant. He's, kind of delusional and all of this kind of stuff. He's also put through a bunch of stuff successfully in a way that other Republican or Democratic presidents couldn't do. So he's getting something done.
I will introduce for the record one takeaway. It's not the, but a that's worth pondering, which is that this process over the last 2 years, a side effect of it, or byproduct of it, is that it basically destroyed the Freedom Caucus, which is kind of interesting. We forget about it now, but in March and April of 2017, the president had serially declared war on Freedom Caucus. He tweeted out, "The Freedom Caucus will hurt the entire Republican agenda if they don't get on the team. We must fight them and Dems in 2018. He was saying this in regards to their opposition to, at that time, healthcare, you know, half-hearted healthcare kind of Obamacare overhauls. Trump's social media guy went after Justin Amash by name. Trump famously later on sort of danced on the grave of Mark Sanford after having on the last minute endorsed his primary opponent. The day, literally, that the that Mueller was announced, that James Comey was fired and the special investigation happened in May 2010, a visibly relieved Mark Meadows and Jim Jordan, who had been called out by name by Trump, they're the head and vice head of the Freedom Caucus, respectively, came out and started saying, well, what we really need to do is to investigate the investigators, maybe impeach, you know, these people. And the Freedom Caucus, to be clear, in 2014 was launched on two or three core principles. One of them was, we need more congressional oversight into the executive branch. We need to make sure that investigations in the executive branch have their independence. And we need to cut spending and go after Obamacare. And they kind of went 0-4 in all of these. They stopped caring about spending. They started caring water for the president. And they started voting the way the president wanted, in a way that went against their founding principles. And now the Freedom Caucus doesn't really exist in the way that had once been kind of copacetic and overlapping with some of our concerns. That doesn't exist anymore as part of this process, which I think is a fascinating thing to look at.
I think that's a really important insight, and it goes to the idea that Trump is like a clarifying force in American politics, and one of his powers is that he takes people and whatever their principles are, he gets them to eat them, you know, and then shit them out and eat them again. And when you look at Jim Jordan in the in recent congressional hearings and whatnot, it's amazing to see a guy who supposedly does everything based on principle and for God and country and all of this, and he's willing to cut and move into whatever direction he needs to in order to maintain or extend his power. I think that's been happening on all sides of the aisle. And this is where I think I disagree with Catherine and Peter of, like, we don't have to accept that. We, you know, because in a way, what the Mueller report shows is Trump is acting like every president does to some degree. He might be a little bit worse than others. But if we accept politicians acting in the most crass kind of politically driven, personal, political, power driven way, then we have no reason to be upset with anything. And we don't have to accept that. And this is where I think we need to be having a different conversation than just that Trump is unfit for office. So what do you do? He's not going to be impeached. Maybe he gets voted out. But what if he doesn't? I think we need to have a discussion that is rooted ultimately about policy and about getting past the idea that all politicians are terrible, so we should never be surprised when they act.
I would like to see a different conversation as well, but I think it's very hard to have a different conversation while Trump is in office. And I think the conversation for most voters is kind of naturally, inevitably, about who they are going to vote for and who is going to be setting those policies.
Because people think about people.
But think about this. Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, in particular, they are staking out. I was just reading a new kind of compilation of what Elizabeth Warren is coming up with, or she's pushing her wealth tax to pay for this, that, and the other thing. But they're coming up with broad visions of what the government should be doing for people. And it's not, you know, they're not saying, and you know, Trump is evil and rotten, and so we have to get rid of him. They're actually making affirmative visions of the future. Trump occasionally does this, but that's what we need to be doing, because that's how you get a different conversation. Like, because otherwise it's like, oh, we have to wait until Trump is voted out of office before we can have a conversation. No, like we can make him smaller by making the conversation different. And there's a bunch of, Republicans, people like Mitt Romney, who should be held accountable, you know, for either rolling with him or not.
Isn't there a third conversation, though? There's the, okay, we should really talk about policy conversation, which, like, here, let's do it. There's the, let's talk about what a hot mess Donald Trump is conversation. But I think that, you know, to me, the insight of public choice is there's the conversation about institutions. How do we, assuming that all politicians are in fact steaming piles of garbage, which we should assume for lots and lots of reasons, how do we build structures around them? And that's why I think the question of, like, should impeachment be more common is a, you know, is a relevant one and probably an under-exercised conversation in this context.
Well, Catherine, let me build on that here. I'm reminded occasionally, was it James Toronto over at the Wall Street Journal, back when he was doing the Best of the Web column, had a homelessness rediscovery watch.
Yes.
Right. Which was whenever there was a Republican president, suddenly the media notices that there's homelessness around. I think that doesn't really obtain anymore, but it seemed hot and fresh in 2003 or whatever. As part of this, some of the more venal Republicans and conservatives out there suddenly rediscovered, only when Donald Trump was at the target of it, that, wow, you know, the FISA court can be abused.
Yeah.
So there's been sort of a criminal justice reform rediscovery watch or something like that. But even despite that throat clear, in the spirit of what have we learned and what can we improve going forward, are there things in your mind, reforms that can be suggested, powers that should be clipped, prosecutorial powers or presidential powers that can be clipped, that this process has kind of shown new light on?
I mean, I think the incredibly drawn out nature of this process seems like it has some lessons in it, right? Like, we spent 2 years perseverating on this hypothetical report, which...
Sorry. What was that word?
Perseverating.
Perseverating?
Is that like what you do when you get really hot at the gym?
Yeah. sort of, actually. No, it's a psychology term. It means like when you have an obsessive focus on one idea and you return to it over and over.
That's cool. Yeah. Thanks for the new word. So
I'm here for you. We spent 2 years perseverating on this report, which ultimately yielded nothing in the way of guidance for future action. And I think that is something that we focus on, how long investigations take when it's something big and high profile and high stakes. But anyone who has ever had any encounter with the legal system, with law enforcement, knows that this is not actually uncommon. I mean, this got a lot of attention, but people often live in legal limbo forever and a day when they are being, especially when they being investigated for something in the white collar zone, because there's often so much paperwork to sort of sort through. There are so many trails to chase down, but also, even people whose offenses are relatively low level and simple can be trapped in these eternal prosecutorial loops. And I think, you know, at the very, very beginning of this process, we had something where Ken White just wrote advice to Donald Trump, which was, don't talk to prosecutors, never talk to prosecutors, never, ever talk to anyone, don't talk to people if you can possibly avoid it. And I think there are lessons for people all the way up and down the scale. But to me, the enormously high overhead and the willingness to extend these type of investigations forever, that's a very broken system. And I would love to see, you know, well, like an 80-20 kind of thing. You know, how could we get most of the value of this thing with much less effort? And I think that would often be the case, especially for these kind of white collar deals. Of course, we could also just get rid of a lot of the laws that people are breaking, for instance, the entire SEC. But that's a separate question.
Suderman, there were a lot of this case kind of sprung from a bunch of leaks that came in December 2016, January 2017, specifically into a counterterrorism investigation that they're supposed to be kind of secret, but into Michael Flynn, then the National Security Advisor, concerning his conversations with the Russian ambassador, Sergei, what's his face? Kislyak, I guess. We learned through leaks in the press, presumably from the counterintelligence operation itself, that Flynn is lying to the FBI about these contacts, that the Trump administration is BSing or at least saying untruths when they say Flynn didn't talk about removing sanctions and so on. Eli Lake and other people have who are not Eli Lake have pointed out, or at least made the argument, that leaking from active counterterrorism investigations is kind of some J. Edgar Hoover level shit. It's hard because you're as the target of this thing that hasn't named you. It's kind of unfair to you, and you're influencing events there. The darker interpretation of this, which you also hear a lot of, is that this is evidence of some kind of soft, slow moving coup. Should we be worried about the role that this leakage played in this investigation, do you think?
I wouldn't say that I am highly concerned about the role of these specific leaks. In general, I think I have a pro-leak bias. I won't say that they're always appropriate, but that's sort of my directional thinking. I would, however, undercut that just a little bit in this specific case. And say that it's pretty clear to me, just from kind of conversations with people around town, but also just looking at how a lot of the big front page scoops and reports were constructed, that the intelligence community, broadly defined, is quite wary of Donald Trump. That's probably an understatement.
Yeah, thanks.
Right? And there is just a huge, within the intelligence community, within that world, which compromises a lot of very smart, very competent, very effective people, there is, they view Donald Trump as a real threat to some combination, and it's hard for these folks in some ways to separate all of this out, but like as a threat to their jobs, the institutions they work for, and the security of the United States, all of which are kind of a blob that you can't really completely separate out. And in some ways, I get it. In many ways, I get it. Donald Trump is, as I said, I don't think he's fit for office. I think he is uniquely kind of incapable and unsavory in a lot of ways, and in particular, his longstanding, this goes back decades, the guy just likes dictators. He thinks they're pretty great. He likes being around them. He likes praising them. He likes doing business with them. He likes doing business in their countries. And that stuff should worry us. But at the same time, I also think that these folks are programmed, are trained to see hidden and conspiratorial stuff going on, when often it's just that Donald Trump kind of likes dictators and building hotels in big cities where they let him build hotels. And that he has as a kind of a mindset, as just sort of like a personal preference in the way that some people like, certain foods or whatever. Like, he just kind of thinks that like strongmen are cool, and like he wants to be like them, right? I mean, like, if you've seen photos of his apartment, right, he has decorated it like some ridiculous third world dictator, because that's kind of his style. That's how he views himself. And so the intelligence community is, in this case, I think, a driver of some paranoia that is unwarranted and misplaced.
We should be really, really concerned, assuming that, you know, the way that you're talking about and the way that Peter is, if the intelligence community, because they don't like the president who, by their own oaths of service, are obligated to follow, have policy disputes, so they start leaking to the press in fucked up ways that start investigations or undermine the credibility of the U.S. government, that should be deeply, deeply disturbing to everybody. And it doesn't mean that they don't have expertise, et cetera, but these are the same people who get their panties in a bunch when a Snowden or an Assange, you know, reveals documents that everybody agrees are true that show the United States in a bad way. I find that really creepy and disturbing. And this is where, for all of the talk that people are like, you know, Donald Trump is burning down old norms and he's making all kinds of horrible behavior possible, it's, you know, again, one of the things that he does is he instigates that in other people, or maybe he just shows that they're doing it too. But that, you know, that should be really unacceptable, the type of thing. Like, you don't like Donald Trump, so then you leak, either within the government or you leak within the press. And again, I'm pro leak all the time for this type of stuff. But when it's in the service of maintaining an intelligence community or a kind of like global hegemonic state, which has a lot to answer for, and certainly people like, you know, who ran the NSA, the CIA, and the FBI, they have a lot to answer for. And so we should not take it. It's not a small thing if they're trying to kneecap.
So I guess I just have a little bit of concern about that. And I admit I'm not completely certain about how I feel. But if we are concerned about the FBI or the CIA or whoever leaking stuff to the American press about the president in order to kind of preserve their own role in power, shouldn't we also be concerned about Russia leaking Democratic?
Leaking.
And yet you have praised. You have also praised Julian Assange and WikiLeaks for releasing that material.
I'm not Russian because the attacks on Assange are always that, oh well, you know, he only leaks stuff that doesn't involve Russia, or he never leaks stuff that is, you know, will undermine Putin or whatever. I don't really care about that in the sense of I'm not a Russian citizen. I'm an American citizen, and I care about what my government does. I think we should know the full extent of attempts, and it sounds like we have a pretty good idea of what Russia tries to do to interfere with elections, other kinds of sabotage or surveillance and spying in an industrial sense. We're certainly looking into that with China. That's all good, and it's really important. But it's like it's a bad answer to say Assange or Snowden are bad because they've only leaked stuff that hurts the United States, especially if you're not a U.S. citizen.
Here's one way of repackaging the comparison, Nick, and I'll address it to you, since you, as Peter pointed out, have defended WikiLeaks and you've been at least partially critical of the Mueller investigation on kind of grounds that it's a distraction based on a sore loser type of approach, the 2016 election, and you like WikiLeaks because it forces transparency.
By the way, the report itself, and I, you know, I've said I haven't read it. I'm relying on, mostly on people at Reason who have read it, but it seems to be, really meticulous and well done and restrained in a lot of ways. So, in a way, that's a model of something.
That's kind of what I wanted to ask you. Is the report itself a kind of useful act of forcing transparency on a kind of serially obfuscatory White House?
This gets to the question, and there, you know, there's that line, and I'm paraphrasing it, but when Trump heard he was being investigated and he said, oh, I'm screwed, you know, like this is going to be the end of my presidency, some people read that as saying, oh, now he knew that he was caught and all of his crimes are going to come to light. The other read of that, which I think is more accurate, is that whenever a president gets a special counsel or special investigator attached to them, it becomes, you know, it's like an open wound that you're going to be bled through for as long as it lasts. And I think, you know, that's a real problem, because if ultimately these investigations really are launched over political issues rather than serious, you know, crimes or problems that need to be dealt with, then it's just another way of kind of weakening the political process in all sorts of ways. And again, like there's no, you know, perfect answer to any of this stuff other than at some point, we should not be shy in expecting our politicians to do better and to be better. Because it can't just be that all they're doing is spending all of the time trying to impeach or get rid of each other, because then, you know, there's actual governance that has to happen and it's not happening. And to the extent that we can hold people accountable to actually do what they're supposed to be doing first and foremost, I think we're going to be in a better situation.
I just want to say again, I think that's wrong, and we shouldn't expect our politicians to do better and be better. I think we should
the conversation is over. No, because what do you do then, Catherine?
I would be happy to tell you. I think that we should instead focus almost all of our efforts on building a system where they do less and are less.
How do you do that? Because the politicians are in charge. I mean, this is like circular logic. We should not say there should be more Justin Amashes in the world. And it's not because we agree with Amash most of the time. It's because he is a paragon of how to act while in office.
I love,
it doesn't mean he's perfect.
As you know, I yield to no man in my love of Justin Amash. But I think the solution can't be more Justin Amashes. The solution has to be ad hoc coalitions of imperfect, selfish douchebags who, in an attempt to stick it to their enemies, wind up constraining their own future behavior.
What's an example that's lasted more than 2 or 4 years until the other douchebags get, you know, put together their ad hoc thing?
I think the filibuster, the existence of filibusters is a great example of that.
which will not last probably.
Right. Well, and that's what I'm saying. It's stuff like the filibuster is in danger. Let's fight to preserve that. Let's fight to preserve this thing that people selfishly use.
What's the last thing that the filibuster actually stopped?
A bunch of bad nominees.
Yeah. It also stopped a bunch of good ones. So, like, what, you know, and, you know, I don't know. I mean, like, if it's merely that politics is always going to attract the scum of the earth and that you cannot make demands on the quality and character and the actions of people who are in office, then, you know, this is a good argument to go for whatever the Benedict option or something and really let's migrate to the cloud and, you know, and play Bitcoin.
Yeah, well, definitely
day.
That too, dude. I'm like, yes, that is a good argument for the Benedict option.
But I don't think that's, I don't think that logic has to go that direction, Nick. I mean, I think you can attempt at all times to reduce the power of the government, period, size and scope of it, period, and find allies right. of it here and there at momentary. I think there's a hyper focus.
But you're not going to be able to. You're not going to be able to because when people don't have confidence that the people in the government or that the government is trustworthy, they're not going to pass laws that take power
Do you
away.
Think, well, actually, I think that would suggest that putting someone like Donald Trump, who everyone, including his supporters, believes isn't trustworthy in the presidency, is not a good idea.
I'm not saying it's a good idea or it's a bad idea. It's a reality, and it's not going to change anytime
soon.
Donald Trump is bad, Donald Trump is bad, Donald Trump is bad, that conversation, which is exactly the one that we've been having since before he entered office, you know, I don't think it's having an effect on you know,
at the risk of attaching electrodes to everyone's genitalia, if you use the word conversation again, let's frame it in this way, which is to say, isn't it striking that possibly the last big example of and it's not true, the last big example, but okay, isn't it striking that in the Watergate era, there was a different reaction? Let's assume for a second that it's okay to compare the two, and that's its own problems. But there was a reaction, not just to Watergate, which we lump with all kinds of things. That's sort of the end of the Vietnam War era, the collapse of a lot of trust and authority that had been going for 10 years, including just kind of a generational thing going on. The Church Commission in particular was a part of this, revealing all of this power abuse in the FBI and the CIA and the post office, for crying out loud. But there was a widespread sense of we need to defrock the executive branch. It has accumulated too much power. It has abused it. It has screwed it up on all sides. And there was a series of reforms that came out of all of that, many of which eventually got undermined or weren't written very, very well to begin with. But that spirit was in the air then as a response to that particular presidential crisis and set of abuses. It's absent here. It's just not part of the conversation. Why? And I'm throwing that out as a jump ball to
the court.
I
would just note that that is how we got the Congressional Budget Office. The 1974 Congressional Budget and Impoundment Act was a reaction to two things. One, Congress didn't like that OMB basically got to make up whatever numbers they wanted to make up, were always just sort of like rosy ass numbers that were designed to make the president look great and say the economy is wonderful. And they were upset about the process of impoundment, where basically the president would take money and do whatever the hell he wanted with it, even though that's Congress's job. And that was a procedural reform. And we could argue with whether all of the effects of the Congressional Budget and Impoundment Control Act were great.
We should probably have
that argument at some point in the future. It's a really fascinating law with a lot of interesting repercussions over several decades. But it was a legislative response that changed how the federal government did business. And I think that many of the effects that it had were more productive than not.
I mean, War Powers Act comes out of that. All kinds of the FISA court comes out of that, does it not?
I think one of the things that has changed, Matt, and you know, you're talking about a moment in the Watergate era when, you know, people like Barry Goldwater would go to the White House and say to Nixon, like, okay, time's up. You know, you got to go for the good of the country. And that type of scenario is virtually unthinkable now. And I think one of the reasons is that the two parties have split, you know, they have sorted into a conservative party and a liberal party. And so that neither party feels it necessary to actually appeal to anybody other than their own constituents, who are tribalists rather than having a political attachment to a group. And that's one of the underlying realities that changed, so that it's much harder now to find people who in the Republican Party who are anything other than absolute Republican loyalists.
There was actually on MSNBC yesterday, one of my co-panelists was a guy named Nick Ackerman, who was a Watergate prosecutor. And one thing that he said, which is frankly like simple to the point that maybe it's embarrassing that I hadn't thought about it before, but he said, listen, a big difference between Watergate and what's happening right now is that the thing at the heart of Watergate was actually and very clearly a crime, that burglary is a crime, and that all of the sort of force of the Watergate investigation descended from the realness of that crime. And the fact that the kind of Russian collusion charge is like a crime question mark, you know, puts the whole thing on a very different ground. And I think there was something about the idea of a literal actual burglary that made the American public's reaction to that different.
So, collusion isn't a crime. And that's part of the thing.
Right, right.
One of the things that it says in the report is like, we don't even really know what collusion means.
Exactly.
Like, there's a
that's what I mean. When I say a
this.
Crime question mark, I guess I should be clear. But I don't think it's a crime.
Conspiracy.
But I think the idea of collusion, conspiracy, and this cluster of kind of stuff that ain't right.
Yeah.
But that's not like actually picking a lock and stealing stuff.
Well, I would just say, though, that part of the story here is the hacking of the DNC, which is very clearly a crime and which a bunch of Russian nationals were indicted for.
But also that the charge of hacking is increasingly being used and abused to go after, you know, people who didn't do hacking in a traditional sense.
Do you think it was in this case?
I have no idea.
Well,
it's too hard.
No, but in any case, the hacking has nothing to do with Trump. Trump was not involved in the hacking. I mean, that much is clear and the report is very clear on that there was no act of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russian various.
Well,
Russian
anyway,
to
play devil's advocate, people would note that that Trump encouraged Russia to hack Hillary Clinton and to release all of her emails on television, right? Like this is not secret.
Yeah,
you know,
no, he said it. Yeah.
And
yeah.
That Don Jr. had a meeting in Trump Tower in which he thought he was going to get dirt on the Clinton campaign. And there's a passage in there that basically says that Don Jr. tried to collude and was too dumb and couldn't do it right. And therefore, because this guy's too stupid, we're not going to charge him.
So should we have not, you know, going back to, you know, old styles of espionage where, you know, American diplomats would say men don't read other men's mail. Should we discount the, you know, what was in those emails that were hacked in the DNC? Because this is also, again, like I find these conversations really frustrating, because what was actually revealed there was as big a threat to kind of American democracy or like, you know, legitimate political process as anything else, which is that The DNC was totally in the tank for Hillary Clinton, and you know, and they were lying about it. They weren't telling Democrats that. They were fucking over the Sanders campaign without him fully understanding what was going on, because they were supposedly a neutral, a neutral platform by which the Democratic Party and the Democrats would select a presidential nominee, and that wasn't true. And this is where, you know, the focus on Trump and the focus on Trump being a scumbag and all of this, totally understandable, but it also kind of, you know, we lose a different thread that's just as important. And that this, to my mind, this is where, you know, the rot in the American political system, it is systemic in the sense that it's all over the place and we need to do better. Like the Democrats, Democrats need to do better than Hillary Clinton and the way that she ran her campaign and took over the party. You know, and Trump is doing something similar now to the RNC, which should also be deeply troubling. But we can't have these conversations if we're merely saying that all politicians are horrible and they're criminals, and that, you know, we can never expect better. And we should focus mostly on Trump's.
I think we need a conversation about conversations.
Electrodes everywhere.
I hope your eyeballs are burning from all your nutsack zapping here. I 3 points of
I'm so upset.
Is that does that make your eyes burn?
If your eyes ain't burning, you ain't trying. 3 points before we bounce to another topic here, just of moderator privilege. When Trump said go ahead and hack it, he wasn't talking about the DNC emails. Everyone sort of conflates those two. He was talking about the lost emails on Hillary Clinton's homebrew server that she took. So those are different sets of emails. Another is that Catherine. You mentioned Nick Ackerman on MSNBC, who I like and have been on a few times before. I will note that I've seen him many times early and often in this process state with utter confidence that there was going to be a conspiracy charge and even conviction in this case. So I wonder if he's talked about that as much on air. And then the other thing, just to reiterate what Nick said about Trump and the RNC, I think what Trump has done with not just kind of influencing the RNC, but swallowing it like a cheeseburger is already more than what Hillary Clinton did with the DNC, with the exception, and it's an important one, is the deception around it. He has openly merged his reelection campaign. He's merged it. They have the same organization and fundraising with the Republican National Committee, 20 months before the election, as opposed to what Hillary did, which is like, no, they're totally impartial and they have some joint fundraising things. And that's interesting to reflect on. And with that, I'm going to stop the Mueller conversation and share with everyone the very exciting news that in the 2020 election on the Democratic side, we now have a new candidate. His name is Seth Moulton. Does anyone know who Seth Moulton is?
I know now because I read something about him when he was like, guys, I'm going to be president. Maybe.
Any idea what state he's from?
Massachusetts.
There you go. Okay, see? I think it's time that we played a Democratic presidential trivia quiz because there's more than 20 here. So can anyone name what city Wayne Messam is the mayor of?
Who's Wayne Messam?
I literally don't know who that is.
He's running for president. I'm not kidding you. He's one of like the official people who've run for president. He is the mayor of Miramar.
I'm literally Googling that now because I'm like wondering if you're pranking us right now.
Nope. John Delaney. Where is he from? Who is he? Anyone know?
Oh, God. I remember this one.
Wayne Messam. Look at this. He's real.
Isn't he?
Hi, buddy.
Yes, John Delaney. I think he's a former congressman now.
I'm going to follow him on Twitter.
One of the richest members.
Oh, that's right. John Delaney is the Maryland congressman who has the healthcare plan.
Hey, wait, can we go back to Seth Moulton? Is that his name? Seth Moulton?
Yeah, sure.
In the one article that I read about him before this podcast, here are two things that I learned that were actually good. One, I'm not a socialist. I'm a Democrat. I want to make that clear. At this point, I do feel like the Democratic field might just itself be a referendum on socialism. So if we can get a majority of candidates who explicitly say they're not socialist, that feels good to me. The other thing is...
Wait, is that you talking or a Moulton talking?
You think I got Moulton kickbacks already? I literally found out who that dude was this morning. Also, he was talking some smack about the idea that Medicare for All is a good idea because he's a veteran and he has found the VA frustrating and terrible. That's good.
New favorite.
That's
good.
New favorite. New fave. Plus, he's a white man, so who doesn't need one more of those?
Catherine's
generic
favorite.
White dude at the top of the field because we don't already have Bernie, Biden, Beto, and Buttigieg up there holding it down.
Moulton's a little younger. Oh, wait, I guess
young is not, at least the age mix is okay up at the top.
We've talked
just
about
the nothing else mix.
We talked about Biden before. He is supposed to announce on Wednesday, although we've heard that song from him in the past a lot, especially in 2015. Gonna announce any day now. Never really did. But it looks like he's finally going to do this just in a kind of a brief time before we start going elsewhere. Isn't he? He's going to get his face ripped off. Is he not, Catherine?
I hope so.
In a competitive
field. I really appreciated your couple of write-ups these last few weeks that have just been like, reminder, Biden's record on criminal justice is so terrible, like so terrible. And it's true that in classic Biden, like, I'm sure you'll forgive me everything way, he's been like, yeah, I might have got some of that stuff wrong. But, you know, the only leading Democrat not to support legalization of marijuana, horrible death penalty for drug dealers stuff in his record. Like he, yes, it, plus the hair sniffing, he is going to be, I look forward to the destruction of Biden once and for all.
Is he, Peter, is he also not like an avatar of the most hated thing in American politics right now, which is kind of the center? Regardless of how you define the center or not, but like his selling proposition is he's Scranton lunch bucket center, and he talked about entitlements for years. I've seen that going around on the social media. Like, my God, what a monster. He said that at some point we have to pay for Social Security, burn his hair plugs now. Is there a center in American politics that's exciting for a Democratic base?
Well, also he's handsy. So, I mean, if you want to like draw up a picture of the Democratic candidate who, like, activists on Twitter are most likely to hate, it would look like Joe Biden, even if it wasn't Joe Biden, right? Like, Joe Biden is literally everything that they despise.
If you made
old,
up
white male handsy, yeah. Once was like, maybe we should balance this budget. Super terrible on criminal justice reform. Has been just around for forever. Voted for the Iraq War. Has always kind of like gone with the flow of the party. Has this like kind of Trumpy working class thing, or a Democratic version of it, and really, you know, wants to appeal to like the J.D. Vance crowd or whatever. I mean, he's really just everything that crowd hates. The question is whether that crowd is going to nominate the president or not.
Whether that crowd represents any kind of reality outside of Twitter, which, you know, I think is a legit question.
And
Maybe not.
There was a pretty good piece in 538 not too long ago that was basically just like Twitter Democrats don't represent the party. And that's, and like if you, it, like every good survey suggests that that highly active social media liberals, progressives, Democratic socialists, whatever, are much younger and much further to the left than the rest of their party and are much more animated about a particular set of progressive concerns, whereas the rest of the party looks a lot more like the Joe Biden part of things. However, because the field is so huge, I think there's going to be an opportunity for somebody, say, like Bernie Sanders, who really appeals to the Twitter Democrats and who has a big a consistent, hardcore, unshakable fan base that is quite unlikely to go away and could basically take it without getting, without really being the candidate of the majority, much in the way that Donald Trump, who had a hardcore fan base, ran basically at the top of the very large field and exploited the fact that the field was so large and that people were sort of had split loyalties, took. In some ways, you know, sort of unexpectedly and not in a really kind of dominating way, but took the Republican nomination in 2016.
Hey, I got a question for the olds. Did people always say out loud, the reason you should pick me is because I'm the one who can beat the nominee in the other party?
Yeah, electability was.
Likability is always a consideration. I think a little electability. Yeah, okay, yeah.
Electability.
Really explicit in this cycle that is a selling proposition. Yeah. And
well, it's two things, Catherine. One is that it is far and away compared to previous cycles, the single most important facet among the Democratic electorate as they're being polled right now. Like it is measurably like, oh, That used to be 40. Yeah. Now it's 57.
No, I understand why it's happening now. I'm just wondering if it's normal.
And it makes sense. And it makes more sense now because you know that whoever the Democrat is, even if it's Joe Biden, they're going to be in the same bubble in a Venn diagram as the other Democrats in a way that, you know, in 1972, that may not have
and
been.
And there were times, and it's usually the times that Democrats come to regret when electability is part of the selling points there. John Kerry in 2004 comes to mind. We're at a time of war. All America was in favor of the war to begin with. Then they sort of like went for the Dean scream, and he came to prominence only really because he was anti-war. Then he was seen as too crazy or something. So John Kerry, what does he do? Like reporting for duty and does the signal. So like he was supposed to be Johnny Electable.
It's kind of a smart move because he was running against a guy who was a warmonger who stepped out during Vietnam, whereas Kerry got shot several times.
A guy who was quite popular as a wartime president in the early aughts.
Oh, Bush was eminently beatable.
If you remember the narratives, right? Like, why was Bush's popularity sort of, why had it surged to 90-something percent? I mean, his popularity after 9/11 and sort of in the early days of the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War was just insane. And so Democrats really felt like they had to co-opt that rather than try to run explicitly against it.
Which is a mistake.
Well, and I don't think they were against the war either. That's part
some,
of the problem.
There were activists big protests that shut down, major arteries in cities
I agree, but they were not Democratic Party things. I mean, Hillary Clinton is still in favor of the Iraq war. You know, I mean, it's like so. But, you know, in the current conversation, too, and I'm looking at a Gallup poll from December of last year, 54% of Democrats want their party to be more moderate, 41% more liberal. 57% of Republicans want their party to be more conservative, 37% more moderate. And this goes to the discussion that we've been having is somebody like Biden is obviously more moderate or more centrist than, Bernie Sanders. But can he get through the activists who actually have an outsized influence in picking the nominee? I don't think Biden can, because beyond all of the other stuff, all of the problems that have been raised, he is old, and it's less that he's the establishment and he's the past. And I think people are done with that. I think the minute that he comes out, it's going to be really interesting. All of the old scores will come out against him, and he'll just be seen as kind of this worn out husk of a bunch of stuff that let's just never talk about it again, including stuff like the drug war and criminal justice, enhanced penalties and all of that kind of stuff. Like we're closing the door on his entire political career.
I was struck, had a piece that ran on the weekend at reason.com, very good website, you should look into it, about Democratic Party candidates for presidents and drug legalization. They're all for it, all of them. I thought it was going to be like
and so is Trump.
Them, most of them, all for it. The top 12 or 13 candidates are all for it. John Delaney, he's on the fence. So the number 13 is it's unclear. But Joe Biden recently, 3 years ago, saying, pot, I don't know about legalizing it because it's a gateway drug. It's like, OK, grandpa, see how the apology tour is going to go for you. It's going to be a nightmare. Speaking of nightmares, let's go to our end of show. What have you been consuming? I suspect that all three of you are going to say the same damn thing. So I'm going to let Catherine go first.
I was not going to say Game of Thrones, but now I just did. I will say instead that I have been consuming Our Planet, which is like yet another installment in the David Attenborough tells us how majestic whales are series. This may or may not be related to an uptick in the consumption of certain substances in my household, but not by me.
Just your kids.
My children. The series is great, you guys. Like, never don't watch well-produced nature documentaries. Also, never go into actual nature is my strong philosophy. There tends to be always one episode in these series, though, where it's like, also, you're ruining the Earth, please stop. So you got to like fast forward through that part. But
just mute it, right?
Because the pictures. Yeah, sure. You can still look at the pictures.
Do you find yourself doing what's his face impersonations? I'm just going to say Wim Wenders. That's the wrong. The other German guy.
Oh, Werner Herzog. Yeah.
Nature is savage. It doesn't like you.
Yeah, I do
it
feel
wants
like
to eat your face off.
I do feel like the Werner Herzog version of these exact same documentaries would be amazing, like just straight up voiceover. Though for those who haven't seen it, I also recommend the Snoop Dogg voiceover of Planet Earth, which is beautiful and perfect.
I've just seen the one where he does, I think he does the snakes.
Yeah. And that's it. That's all. I mean, it's not like he did the whole thing. It's like 100 hours of video. But yeah, it's great. It's
national treasure. Nick, what have you been consuming?
I rewatched the recent Theranos documentary on HBO because Elizabeth Holmes has a court date today, and we may be finding out when exactly her trial will begin. Theranos is the fake blood draw business that has captivated a lot of people.
They did really draw the blood in their defense.
So
that part was real.
And actually, the big problem was that they were essentially doing just traditional blood draws when they were supposed to be using high tech. And then I did watch Game of Thrones, and I just want to point out, as much praise as we were lavishing on it last week, what a
You're
terrible
so
episode.
You're so wrong. I was trying
season,
not to fight this fight with you.
It was so
fan
so
service.
Bad. And Matt, you would have loved it where like they even had everybody hanging out at campfires, like tearing up, getting ready
yes.
for the big battle, which hopefully will start next week. Although I'm half expecting it's going to be like an episode of Moonlighting where somebody fantasizes that they're back in the 1940s doing a USO show during World War II.
Honestly, just, that's the only
they
thing
don't
that
have
could
any
make
material.
That better. If that happened, I would be so happy.
Then I'm all in. But it's like, what's so bad at Matt? It's like they were singing fake Irish folk songs. It was like I was expecting Van Morrison to show up like busking around.
Did they have the gun?
Did
they have
so
the damn Tim whistle?
Bad.
Like the plaintive hobbit
oh,
whistle?
Oh, yeah. 100%.
Of course. Yeah. No, I have to say, as much as I enjoy the series, and I do, it's like I'm kind of getting sick of like fantasy world movies about, like, you know, why do I have to cry that Thor or Thor's brother dies or like some fake people? We've got like lots of actual historical wars that we could be representing
what?
In art and literature. So Game of Thrones
is your
on notice.
Worst take wow. in a lifetime of bad takes.
No,
wow.
No.
It's beautiful.
Sorry.
It was touching.
Sorry.
It brought together all the characters we love.
Was it? It didn't
it
even
looked
look
great.
Good. It didn't even look good. I'm
Flickering
watching on like a
48-inch
screen TV, an HD TV.
It was Helm's Deep, oh but for Game God. Of Thrones. Why and would it, you not love it?
Speak.
Bad sex, like virtually no sex. Like
Arya
what happened
got,
to that? You know, somebody
spoilers.
Needs to be taking extends or something.
Speaking of Helm's Deep, my entry into this was I went to the.
Speaking
Morgan
of Helm's Deep is your segue always, isn't it?
Well,
a little bit in your heart. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Carry on.
I went to the Morgan Library, which I hadn't been to before in Manhattan, New York. Manhattan's a bureau, one of the five bureaus.
The island of Manhattan.
Of New
York.
Yeah. Quick quiz, Catherine. What is the only of the five boroughs that's on the mainland United States?
I don't know.
Thank you.
The Bronx.
If you'd asked me Morgan Library trivia, I would have been ready. But that one, I got nothing.
So Morgan Library has an exhibit that runs out in mid-May. That I recommend to people who, like me, read The Lord of the Rings consecutively 23 times, beginning when they were 9 years old. It's a J.R.R. Tolkien exhibit. It's small for the low price of 20.
Oh, is it talking about his stupid Catholicism?
It doesn't.
Sorry.
It doesn't okay, too much. The father, like Francis or whoever, took over his child rearing once his mom died when he was 12. Played a somewhat of a role, but it's mostly just about his beautiful drawings and watercolors that he did more than I had previously been aware of, and like map making and language inventing as a teenager. It brought to mind a phrase that Peter Suderman uses when I'm otherwise nodding off at the end of these podcasts of world building. It is such an astonishing amount. You can see, the level of detail that he went to create a universe on which the Hobbit and then Lord of the Rings was just kind of like a small part, but just like constantly reworking these maps to make sure this line works better and several languages. It's just a very impressive and small and digestible.
Matt, if you had delivered this in the original Elvish, it would
that
be
is,
much more
That is true. And the other small detail that's kind of poignant that my wife, who I dragged along to this, points it out. It was very touching. It like talks about his life a little bit in some of his letters, and particularly his fatherhood. He spent a lot of time writing and parenting from the same kind of room. He famously had written parts of the chapters of Lord of the Rings and sent them off to his kid, who's off in World War II. But as an orphan, it suggested without really saying it, pointing it out explicitly in this exhibit, but just gets you to thinking that the kind of creation of the Shire as this hearth of all hearths, this great village and stuff, was in some way kind of, he wanted to create a thing that never existed for himself. And it's kind of touching and beautiful on that sense. And his own kind of elaborate and early for its time, like a super involved fatherhood, even as a full-time professor and as a literature professor, author, is very touching.
Yeah. A tenured radical, Matt. They don't even have to keep office hours. They don't do any work, and they just get paid by the state. Haven't you been reading David Horowitz's
that's
books?
That's all I have. Hating Whitey, yeah. Volume 7. Suderman, what have you been reading?
Your mention of J.R.R. Tolkien's world building there, totally a Suderman term, it's true, although obviously not an original, made me think of, I was reading a fascinating piece about the making of the Elder Scrolls 3, or 4? Sorry, 3. Morrowind?
Please, can you double check that, Peter? Because really so much depends on the Red Wheelbarrow and Elder Scrolls.
It's Morrowind. And it was the first of these big RPG games in a series that I'm really fond of. And one of the guys who was like one of the kind of head creators who was sort of came from the world of tabletop games. And he was talking about how he was training all these younger kids to build this game. And what he would do was he would just sort of make maps and build characters and be like, in this place, there's like, here's 6 characters, and they have, each of them has this personality. And then the level designers and the sort of the actual people who would write the stuff would just be like, oh, I can have the character go to this place, and there will be this character there that has this personality that I can use and these resources. And so it was all about sort of planning and building out the world first, and then you would figure out what kind of story would take place in it. It's really kind of fascinating.
Has the physicality, the disappearance of the physicality of maps, like, is that going to change things? Because thinking about this, my brother used to subscribe to National Geographic, and almost every issue in the 70s, it seemed, had this, you know, elaborately detailed maps of all sorts of stuff. And, you know, I certainly lost myself in this. This is one of the reasons why I'm drawn to these shows that I end up hating for whatever reason. But, you know, when you don't have a physical map that you can kind of look at, and I'm thinking, and this might just be, you know, generational, of like tabletop games and things like that too, which had, you know, maps of varying degrees of specific detail in them. But can you build the world when you're
not
actually drawing the map?
So there are virtual maps for all these games,
you know,
that are incredibly
space.
Detailed and rich, yeah. And that people get really deeply lost in. And in fact, I think in some ways the virtual map obsession can be just as, if not more, powerful and grip people. I know a guy who works for a mapping company where they sort of try to figure out ways to do this usefully, but like part of it is like they're all just super obsessed with all these incredibly detailed digital maps that can be created. And if you go back... I recently, just a couple of weeks ago, finished reading Neil Stephenson's Rimdi for the second time, and I'd forgotten how many passages there are where, like, the main character is just sort of like, I've I really love Google Maps and looking at stuff on Google Maps. And it's about one of the characters. The part of the book is about a video game world that has been created in extremely, extremely rich detail with like incredible, like actually, you know, functioning mountain geography and all of this. And so, like, I think digital maps can really, for a certain type of person, take the same, play the same role. In any case,
and to be clear,
actually,
Peter is that person.
I was going to say, I recently went on Google Maps and, you know, typically I just use it to get directions and stuff. And I went into the 3D and into the street level, and the amount of information that they are constantly tying in, like new sources, new images, all of that. It's, you know, and I mean, mostly now when we talk about Google or Facebook, we talk about how they're invading our privacy, blah, blah, blah. But it's like, it's pretty incredible what's going on. And it is a virtual world that is, you know, coming closer and closer to kind of like an augmented reality that I think is going to be totally, totally.
Speaking of the physical world, though, that we still live in, I apologize for distracting us with that. But I did consume homemade Amaro, which I'm a big fan of Italian bitter liqueurs. And so for the last several months, I have been working on making my own. Basically, what you end up doing is infusing bitter roots and herbs into Everclear, which is super, super, super high-proof neutral grain alcohol. You can use other types of high-proof alcohol as well. I did mine with Everclear, which is the most common base. You let it sit for a bunch of weeks, and then you mix it down so that instead of being 190 proof, it ends up being about 60 or 30% alcohol by volume. You mix it down with sugar and water, and so you have this kind of interesting, super funky, floral, super bitter, but also slightly somewhat sweet liqueur. The one that I made turns out to make a pretty good white Negroni, and then I started another batch over the weekend. It's a really fun exercise and experiment for anybody who is into bitter liquor.
I just want to know who died and said that you can have two.
That wasn't. I was just consuming. Just talking about yours.
A build off of yours.
I was just telling people about.
Wow.
World building.
Wow. Catherine is giving him license. That's.
Just this once.
This is like the White House press corps. You know, always asking two questions.
Right. Well, and to be fair, the people who say I have a three-part question in any kind of public forum are the greatest monsters and should be taken out into the street and shot.
The only worst monster, as we all know, is the person who gets up and doesn't have a question and just starts haranguing them, usually about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
This is more of a comment than a question.
Murder.
Yeah. This is a three-part comment.
This is a one-part comment, and I'm going to say goodbye and thank you for listening. Subscribe to us everywhere. Write nice reviews and also accurate reviews. And stay tuned for more podcasty goodness, and goodbye.
Seems like it'd be hard to do both.